formality and the Russian system. Could you tell us where does this one fit in your longer intellectual trajectory?
Well, I'm a believer in slow cooking. So my formula for this very short book is 3 + 3 = 1, which is to say I worked on Russia from the informal point of view and the role of informal networks at the everyday level in the first book, business and political networks in the second book, and the top Kremlin-based networks for informal governance in the third book. And then I estranged myself from Russia completely. I effectively left the field in 2013 and started the Global Informality Project because, first of all, I wanted to check the universality of Russia. Second of all, I wanted to see what's happening elsewhere and to compare notes, as it were. And I also wanted to understand informal practices as a phenomenon, not just informality in Russia. With those three volumes of the encyclopedia, it allowed me to look at Russia in a different way, sort of in a context-sensitive, comparative way. And that has been quite interesting and different. Hence, it allowed me to do the short book, because once you see the pattern, you could almost capture it in one picture or in one soundtrack, as we've discovered. Benjamin was telling his audience at my recent book launch that he actually first thought that the book was about Russia. But once he started working on music, he discovered that actually patterns are universal. Music is probably the best means to communicate that. Yeah. So that's why 3 + 3 = 1.
Yeah. And finally, you know, we started with this line of yours that the West is obsessed with Putin but is not interested in Russia. For us, say in the United States, why should we care about Russia beyond Putin? Because for us, it's like, well, what is the threat? This is our main kind of concern. What would you say to somebody, let's say a layperson or even a student who might be interested in Russia? What should they care about and why?
Well, first of all, I would say one shouldn't care about Russia. That's what I would say. I mean, hugely inflated approach. Maybe because we cannot face China, Russia is the best proxy. Maybe. But if one does care about Russia, it's better to get it right. Especially, there has been quite a lot of discussion about Russia being a convenient enemy, in the sense that it's not really big. Its population and the corresponding market is small. There are issues within Russia that would ever keep it. I think Rusana said it in the beginning, right? So Russia always catches up. And there are certain fundamental patterns which actually make sure this is the case. And it's not just Soviet inherited infrastructure, which was not market-oriented. There are massive factors which I explain associated with the climate and geography and all the usual suspects which were part of the is Russia a normal country or is Russia an abnormal country type of debate.
Right.
But I think maybe people are fascinated by Russia because it's actually complex and it's multi-layered. And I particularly see a lot of interest from those people who have been. Every time I have a US student who come to London to do a postgraduate degree or a PhD, they want to understand how it really works. And that's why they end up with attention to things which are fundamentally elusive, which are hidden practices, which are open secrets, and which are unwritten rules. And that's the know-how, the savoir-faire, that's non-dit, that's the elephant in the room. And that's what my project, I hope, helps people to get.
That was Alena Ledeneva. Alena Ledeneva is professor of politics and society at the University College London and a founder of the Global Informality Project. She is the author of the trilogy, Russia's Economy of Favors, How Russia Really Works, and Can Russia Modernize? Her new book is The Russian Pendulum, Paradoxes, Practices, and Patterns, published by UCL Press.
Thank you very much, Rusana. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
This episode was edited and mixed by Daniel Cooper at Podcuts Editing. And we are the Eurasian Knot, which is sponsored by the Center for Russia and East European and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. And listeners just like yourselves, help us out by spreading the word with the podcast. Turn people onto it. And drop us a line. We have a couple of people who've written us. We should probably highlight some of those things. We got a good thing about Kurt Vonnegut, actually.
Oh, yeah.
That we'll share next time. Yeah. And of course, you know, become a patron. This is a nonprofit endeavor, and we can always use your support. Until next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Но макало маканкерел, но мане хутло давла ходом я мораву, но маканце ханце. Я махарабу. Хола гаркыл ханахда. Даган хан даван хан керерел. Даван ехутыл давал хадам. Я махараву, дару хансе хансе жерел, дага сане шутр шут хедым я махараву.
Kalalik Nunat. Greetings from the Netherlands. We are standing in front of the U.S. consulate in Amsterdam to show our support to you. We strongly denounce the threat from the aggressive bully Donald Trump to Greenland. That is why we all say, I'd like you to join me, keep Greenland Trump free!
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 Thank you. And please remember, you are not alone. Ilit kisimin gilatit. Greenland for the Greenlanders. Kalalit nunat, kalalinut. Stay safe! Dank jullie heel hartelijk voor jullie aanwezigheid.
around, and I guess that I just don't know, and I guess guess that I just don't know. My wife and it's my life, because a minute my thing leads to a center in my head, and then I'm better off than dead. Cause when the blood begins to flow, then I really don't care anymore about all your gems in this town, and everybody putting everybody else down, and all the politicians making crazy sounds, and all the dead bodies piled up and down. That heroin is in my blood, and that blood is in my head. Thank God I'm good as dead. Thank your God I'm not aware. Thank God I just don't care. And I guess I just don't know. And I guess that I just don't know.
Mr. Lewis, isn't it time that he was out on his own? there's a future for you in the fire escape train. Come up to town. When I remembered a voice from the past. Gambling only pays when you're winning. Had to thank old Miss Ford for schooling a failure. Keep them moving sharp.
I'm just a lawnmower. You can tell me by the way I walk.
Yeah. Hello, welcome to Repeater Radio. We're here talking with Kit McIntosh about his remarkable book, Neon Screams, How Drill, Trap and Bashment Made Music New Again. It's the book that rewrites the 2010s as a revolutionary period for music, a decade in which, despite all the doubters, the future is suddenly on again. Apart from its, quality and surprise as a quality as writing and a surprise as an intervention in music writing. Something else that is remarkable about it is that it's not only Kit's first book, but it's his first published writing anywhere. And you don't have Kit, you don't have a background in music journalism.
No, not at all. No.
You're a musician.
Yeah, yeah, musician, producer, mainly, yeah.
And I gather you didn't really even grow up like reading, you know, music tapes online or in print, you know.
Well, I mean, sort of, by the time I was sort of a teenager, music, you know, by the age you're interested in music, probably the internet had taken over by then, so you had this sort of democratization of who's talking about music. So it probably went from, you know, the magazines and all that, the music press, to people on Twitter, people on forums, whatever else, blogs.
So we'll give us an introduction first. Just say a little bit about you're young. Tell us about your journey to this point where you've actually written a book, remarkably.
Well, yes, I grew up in South London, sort of kids at school, you know, dance hall was very big, kind of grew up during the road rap era, and that kind of turned into drill. Because I played music, obviously very interested in all sorts of music, so kind of interested in like 70s Miles Davis, and then got interested in like jungle, grime, that kind of stuff as well. And then got in touch with you, and things got forward from there, really.
And so you're, what, like 25 now?
Yeah.
And this book is like accumulation, I guess, of thoughts you've been having since...
It covers a little over a decade, but with a real focus on really the last 3 or 4 years, maybe.
And, you know, it's what's exciting about the book is it's like got this tone of great urgency, and it has that characteristic young man's desire to tell the elders to fuck off. You know, basically, you've got it all wrong. This is not a boring time for music. There's all these things going on that you either not notice or you don't understand. So it sort of relates to this thing that I've sometimes talked about, where I use this idea of, like, you know, the young people have a biological right to be excited about the time they're living through, you know, musically, and in other respects probably. Is that something, you know, is that something that you feel? It seems to be a lot of the imperative behind the book is to sort of, you know, shout loud.
Yeah, well,
this is an exciting period.
It's funny though, because there's sort of a dual impulse. Because, I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, the book does probably hammer down on the side of fuck you, music's great, fuck off, granddad. but yeah, and so I think that's, you know, definitely right. I mean, also you have had this kind of thing of, say, you know, you wrote Retromania, you had Mark Fisher talking about kind of slow cancellation of the future. So you have had this. I mean, I even stumbled across the thing from Wire magazine just the other day, from 2014, where someone was talking about music no longer being innovative and all that. So it is sort of seems to be this kind of orthodoxy that's taken hold, at least in certain sort of intellectual or commentariat circles. And I thought it was just completely wrong. So I thought that needed addressing. But it is interesting because there is another part of me that actually quite likes to tie all this stuff. It's a continuation of, you know, the kind of Afrofuturist lineage. So if you're into 70s Miles Davis, or you're into in jungle, you're into grime, blah, 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 this is that same instinct and impulse realised for today. But that being said, if you play it to certain people of a certain age, a lot of the time they fucking hate it, even if they're into the Miles or the jungle.
Well, let's get into the sort of the master thesis then of the book, or the claim, which you're saying, the gist of it is that the people looking in the same old places for where the future might manifest are missing where it's actually manifesting. So let rip with the
well,
claim.
Yeah, so I think you probably had a kind of a certain paradigm in the discourse that would have arisen, I'm sure, out of you, out of Kojo Eshan, out of Mark Fisher, and you kind of, this notion of musical futurism that you would have got from dance music, post-rave dance music. And so really, I think a lot of the people who are mourning that they don't think there's a future, I think one problem is they're still looking in that kind of post-rave, post-jungle tech, they're looking in, you know, in dance music. Listen, that's not really where the future's at. But that speaks to a bit more of a kind of profound or subtle shift, paradigm shift as well, which is, say, in the 90s, innovations would have arose really from, if you're doing something clever or novel with samplers, or synthesizers. So if you think of the Mentasm synth or the SD bass, so that's fine, you know, making a new sound with a synthesizer, same with the Acid House. Well, or, yeah, as I say, sampler, so speeding up a breakbeat or speeding up a vocal, or, you know, the sort of chopped or screwed thing of actually slowing them down or chopping them up, whatever it is. So those things seem to be pretty kind of obsolete as mechanisms for innovation. So now it's the digitally processed voice. So that starts with auto-tune, but then really what people are doing is either combining auto-tune with tons of different effects, which you get a lot in dancehall at the moment, or with kind of very novel, strange vocal performances that then the auto-tune kind of really accentuates. So basically the voice, or the digitally processed voice, is the new synthesizer. It's now, you know, or it's the, you know, say in the 60s, kind of the electric guitar would have been this technology of innovation. So that's our modern day thing. And so I call this vocal psychedelia, and even go so far as to say, you know, you could, you know, we still call a lot of the music I talk about in the book, you know, trap or rap or dancehall or bashment or whatever it is, but really the difference between what's coming out now and the dancehall of old or the rap of old, it's as stark as difference to say the difference between rap was and funk back in the day, or house was to disco. So I'd say it's a sort of a new macro genre, and I give it the name vocal psychedelia.
And one of the ideas in it, you know, if you look at in terms of hip hop, is that rather than you know, being about lyrics, it's about the voice as the sort of source of texture, isn't it, and of strange rhythmic, almost toretic kind of expulsive sounds that, you know, aren't really communicating anything as such, but have this kind of static, yeah, triggering sensation sort of from the listener.
Yeah, definitely. So as I say, it sort of with a lot of the tracks, it be the voice is more comparable to synth than it is to an old rap thing, you know. So to judge, say, Quavo by the standards you judge a Raekwon or a Nas or whatever, it's sort of is ridiculous. But actually, to compare Quavo to, in the book I compare him, I think, to Todd Edwards, this thing of chopping up samples, this kind of very hyper fragmented rhythmic quality. So again, there's been a whole paradigm shift in which the sort of the meaning of what the voice can do, or what it, how it functions in music, totally inverse from it would have been 20 years ago.
One thing, you know, you in the book you talk about mumble rap, which I guess is a term that has achieved some currency. Often initially as a totally negative term, you know, these new rappers aren't rapping properly, they're just mumbling, drooling out this dribble, and it's the decline of old MC skills, and that became positivized. But you also have your own term. You do the classic sort of music writer as prophet, as neologist, as identifier of genres thing. You have this term that you've invented, frag rap. Do you want to explain mumble and frag and how they're different? Who are the exponents of things?
Well, I mean, mumble rap probably more broadly is used to describe all sorts of stuff. I kind of try and narrow it down to kind of a proper set of conventions in the book. So, but basically with mumble rap, you're going to be rappers taking the voice, taking auto-tune, and kind of doing very strange, very novel, different vocal deliveries to kind of enhance these kind of futurizing textures you can get with auto-tune. Then I'd say frag rap, you could, maybe it's a sort of a sub, kind of another subdivision of mumble rap, or possibly it's its own thing, but that's more focused on a rhythmic quality where your rapper's doing these hyper fragmented, you know, Todd Edwardsification of rap, if you will. That's the kind of hyper fragmented raps, you know, kind of everything chopped up between kind of maybe one or two syllables at a time, lots of ad libs, which are these kind of background vocal interjections. But the two overlap a lot. But I suppose the interesting thing with frag rap is you're taking the innovative kind of timbral language of mumble rap and then introducing an innovative rhythmic language as well. So you're just up in the stakes with that.
And Migos are like the exemplars, right? The pioneers of this fragmented, eruptive kind of rapping, and where it seems to dance amongst these three voices, and you have the ad libs are as important almost as the actual main vocal line, and then you have this third layer. It's almost like a terraced sound. You have this third layer, these bizarre gurgling sounds that I think it's usually Quavo emits that are just like, what's the term you used to describe them? Moans from a Martian crypt or something like that.
Very nice. Yeah. Well, I mean, again, it's sort of again with this sort of thing of a vocal psychedelia, you can see that thing of, so you've got one layers of rap, then you've got ad libs, then you've got these kind of sung bits as well. All interweaving, all chopping and changing. So again, it is this kind of disorientation via kind of digital voice.
And some of those sounds in the background, I mean, you know, I hate to use a sort of, seems to go against the spirit really of your book to sort of bring in some rock canonical reference voice, but it actually reminds me a lot of Tim Buckley's Star Sailor, the track Star Sailor, which is this amazing voice scape where his voice is like these filaments of goo, you know, and shimmering pulses. But you know, these kind of sounds are going on in the middle. For me, it's exciting that these sounds are going on in the middle of songs that like have, you know, I think some of the Migos songs have like a billion views on MTV. You know, they sold millions of, I don't know, records, yeah. Streams at this point. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the nice thing with the book is that you do have a real kind of, you've got stuff that's super, super underground. And then stuff that, yeah, as you say, it's sort of huge, big stars. So it's quite sort of, I can have my cake and eat it, really. Because I'm not just sort of hyping up lots of obscure stuff that has no kind of societal or social impetus. But then on the other hand, you know, it's always nice to like cool underground music as well. So yeah, it sort of covers a whole range of stuff. Yeah.
And then sort of going beyond Migos, I guess the person who's taken first in terms of this abstractification of the voice, is Playboi Carti, right?
Speaking of kind of combining the mumble rap thing with kind of novel delivery with this fragmented thing. So Playboi Carti, I guess it would have been maybe a couple of years ago now, there's a whole bunch of tracks that got leaked online. It would be kind of 1 minute snippets of tunes where his voice just sounds bizarre. A lot of fans will call it his baby voice because it's sort of quite high pitched and weird. He's doing that, and yeah, then with just these kind of, it's all just kind of ad lib. There's no real sense of cohesion in the voice, of kind of rhythmic narrative, none of that. That's all gone. You've just got these kind of burps and hiccups of strange digital noise. So yeah, so I think that stuff is kind of taking on, you know, what you get with Quavo and taking that step further.
And you use this term vocal psychedelia, and that sort of, you know, invites thinking about the drug aspect of this. You know, in the Energy Flash, I use this term, the drug tech interface. And is there, you know, is there a sort of, can you actually talk, is there like a direct line between the kind of sensations that the kind of drugs being used, which are often misused prescription drugs like Percocet and Xanax, and there's also like codeine laced. What's this chemical that's in coffee? It's not just codeine, there's another chemical, isn't there? It's like, and they collect vintage bottles of this stuff, it's no longer made. It's got a chemical name, I can't remember. And there's loads of other drugs as well, whatever it's going. It's like a polydrug culture, but can you draw a line between the kind of sensations and affects that these, you know, heavily abused drugs relate to particular technological things to do with auto-tune and other effects you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, well, as you say, because it's polydrug thing, you sort of have all probably kind of various and sometimes even contradictory drug impulses also manifest in the music. I mean, say the thing of the MDMA. So as I say, the fact that these kind of new fragmented rhythms, they do have their kind of you know, predecessors a bit in kind of dance music where you had the voice chopped up, so you could see that maybe that is something that MDA likes, these kind of, you know, quick sort of the stabs of stimulation. So that's one thing. Then a lot of the instrumentals can be quite ambient or dissociative, and that kind of fits in with more the codeine based drugs. But even the kind of rhythmic language, I think when you really kind of, you know, when you get like intoxicated by the music, you know, when the music really kind of gets you, those are the thing of the rhythmic language, the thing of having all these voices chopped up, I think they do become very, that again as this very hyper-dissociative thing where it's hard for the body to quite relate to. It's sort of, it, a lot of it feels very kind of solipsistic, kind of it happens in the mind. So it's sort of so physical to the point it goes becomes kind of paraphysical. And again, so you could, I think that's quite a druggy sensation.
And that, you know, you bring up the word dissociation, and it does seem like the, you know, the affect in this music does seem on the whole to be quite bleak, like it's sort of numbness, detachment, you know, even as they're like the lyrics such as they are, still, you know, this fantasia of expensive watches, Pateks and swimming pools and women and endless wealth and luxury. There's a kind of bleakness and a blankness in there. You know, Mark Fisher used this term of depressive hedonism, which I think is a culture-wide phenomenon, but it's particularly pronounced in rap of the last decade from people like Drake, Kanye West, over to this stuff that you're talking about. Do you think it speaks to our times in a way, this sort of the kind of, obviously people love this music and it speaks to them on some level, even that cuts through even the lyrics, you know, there's something about that, just the actual mentality and emotions and sensations in the music seems to be the music that young people relate to. So how is that, what kind of portrait does that make?
So there's a guy called Luke Davis who used to be a grime blogger called Heronbun, and he has this brilliant idea of what he calls dematerialization. So he basically thinks that, you know, kind of as we increasingly interface with kind of software, you know, as we increasingly live in the, you know, in our phones and in our computers and all that, you kind of have this detachment from material reality. Sort of, he thinks that's reflected, you know, in art everywhere. So everything from, you know, neo-futurist architecture to kind of this music. So yeah, so I think a lot of it, you could kind of, this detachment from any kind of physical, real world physical sonic signifiers. I think a lot of part of that is just the fact that all the music's now happening inside the computer. So there's no sample, so you're not hearing the sound of a wooden drumstick hitting a real drum. That's all in the computer. And then even the point now where the voice has been digitized through auto-tune, whatever else. So yeah, so you're probably losing any kind of textual evocation of the real physical world. So I think probably that speaks to our times. Yeah.
One thing that you do in your book, which is very interesting, is you really center the Caribbean in your story. The book starts with dancehall at the sort of turn of the 2010s. Vibes Cartel is a totemic figure. Yeah, Alkaline and Tommy Lee Starter, but you know, it's not just. I said the Caribbean and say Jamaica because there's a lot about Trinidad. You know, there's this genre Trinibad, which I've never heard of, I don't think many people know about it. Maybe, but it's, you know, we'll talk about that. Talk about you. Do you feel like Vibes Cartel is where it all kicks off? This extreme use.
Yeah, so Cartel, basically, so you have the kind of auto-tune really gets going in kind of what you could call street music, the second half of the 2000s, so you know, your T-Pain, your Kanye West, all that stuff, in this, all the kind of American, first wave of American auto-tuned rap, I think auto-tune doesn't particularly sound like anything special. It sort of sounds like Vocoder Part 2. None of the music particularly, you know, you're not getting that shock of the new thing with that. Whereas the music Cartel was making at the same time, that really does kind of, that promises a whole new kind of a future of music, which I think, you know, been delivered in the past 10 years. So yeah, so I think Cartel was the first one to take auto-tune and kind of put so much kind of aggression and make it emotional into it. Yeah, and so I think he kind of, you could kind of, he's year zero of vocal psychedelia, really. And the fact that throughout his career, he's managed to kind of evolve and change his dance also. So the new music he makes fits in with what's going on now. He's not stuck in 2009.
But I mean, we should probably point out, because I don't think that many people know this. I mean, he's like the dominant figure in dance over the last 20 years,
he has this sort of title in Jamaica, but he's beyond, say, a Beanie Man in the 90s, sort of making a dance hall. He goes beyond that. He's probably got that kind of near deific quality that Bob Marley would have had. It's this kind of, real kind of cult personality around him. The thing is, he bleached his skin, so he kind of lightened its complexion using chemicals and kind of popularized that. He kind of broke taboos about oral sex and all sorts of stuff. So he sort of, it goes beyond celebrity. It is kind of a cultural force emanating from one man.
And is he very, I should imagine this is very controversial, bleaching your skin in Jamaica. It must be, a lot of people must think it's aggressive and,
when Britain ruled Jamaica, there was this kind of caste system put about by the British, where lighter skinned Jamaicans would get preferential treatment than people with darker skin. So it's been a taboo in Jamaica ever since. So Buju Banton did a song about in the 90s about fancying light skinned girls, and he got a huge backlash, and then had to do another song saying he loved dark skinned women as well. So it's sort of very controversial. So Cartel come out and do that. Yeah, it was a huge kind of scandal in Jamaica. I mean, it's still controversial, 10 years later.
And you relate it to a thing which I guess is a kind of, you relate it to the sort of digital transhumanism, right? This kind of thing which certainly this idea that, there's a sense that when you see people, a lot of people, I think, in everyday life who are trying to look digital, trying to look like the digitally filtered and enhanced and doctored images of themselves that they propagate on the internet and people and stars and influences they see. It sort of fits into that as well, as this idea that the self is plastic and that you can kind of
that's the thing, and that's been taken further and further by each successive wave of dancehall artists. So you think, did Cartel bleach in his skin, and you've already got this kind of transhuman quality, but then this guy Alkaline comes out a few years later, so he's also bleached his skin, but then he's got these kind of, his eye, he doesn't have like, he's just got massive pupils, he looks like a deer or something, and he told everyone that he tattooed his eyeballs. And you even have people trying to tattoo, someone attempted to have a tattoo on their eyeball and almost blind themselves, trying to copy him. And then 3 years later, he came out and said, oh no, it's just contact lenses. But the damage was already done. And then you've got this guy now called Intense, again with the bleached skin, but he's also got a third eye tattooed on his forehead, which inspired, we've got like a character on the front cover of Neon Screams. He's got a third eye in his head. You have all that, and the thing with the Cartel, the bleaching thing, is there's this sort of a transhumanist polemic in the 70s, in which the writer does predict that in the future black people might want to lighten their skin. So this is sort of Cartel, he's sort of manifesting an idea of the future. An idea of the future actually come to life.
Tell us about Trinidad. Why you think that's like the next quantum loop in this? I don't know much about Trinidad except that it's quite a small island, and that's where soca comes from, right?
That's the funny thing. I don't particularly think Trinidad has a kind of history of dancehall, or at least any dancehall anyone cares about.